You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We have a smorgasbord of a show for you today. I am joined by the wonderful Fran Quinn to talk about her new book, The Lost Passenger, which is set around the sinking of the Titanic. We talk to D.E. White about a workshop she is running in Horsham about writing crime. We talk to Corinne and Miff from the first graphic novel competition to find out all about graphic novels and how and why you should enter this really exciting competition that actually has a prize of not only cash but publication. We talk to Sam and Anna from the Forthright Festival to talk about everything they've got going on, from panels to workshops in March in Brighton and in Crawley. So that's in Brighton on the 15th of March and in Crawley on the 30th. And we talk to recent Brighton resident Brooke Robinson about how she is working her way through every single cafe in Brighton to write her absolutely gripping high concept thrillers. I also have details about a one-day affordable writing retreat in Brighton, which I am hosting, and I would love you to come to. Enjoy the show. England, 1912. Tricked into a bitterly unhappy aristocratic marriage and powerless to keep her beloved son Teddy from being sent away, Eleanor Coombs sees a cold and lonely future ahead. So a present from her father, tickets for the maiden voyage of a luxurious new ship called the Titanic, seem to offer a brief but welcome escape with Teddy. When the ship goes down, Eleanor realises that she can seize the chance to take Teddy and start a new life in America, but only if they disappear completely, listed among the dead. Penniless and using another woman's name, she has to learn to survive in a world that couldn't be more different from her own. And when a face from the past appears, she must risk everything to keep her secret and her son. An uplifting story about grabbing your chances with both hands and being brave enough to find out who you really are. Fran Quinn is back on the Brighton Book Club to talk about her wonderful new book, The Lost Passenger. Welcome back, Fran.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
When did the idea for this book come to you?
It kind of floated into my head, funnily enough, being about a ship. I wanted to... My last two books were historical and they were set in periods that were very British. And I wanted something that would have a bit more of an international appeal. I really wanted the book to be published in America. And so I was thinking, well, what does everybody know about? And the Titanic came into my head. And then the idea for the book came... I think I was reading about 9/11, where there was some discrepancies about who was actually in the building, and I think there was somebody who disappeared and they didn't know if he was in the building, and that gave me the idea of, okay, that must have been true of the Titanic. That night, it must have been such chaos. If that was a time you wanted to be disappearing, that was the time to go for it. And I kind of worked backwards from there, thinking, well, who is this woman who wants to disappear and why does she want to disappear?
And what was your research process behind getting into kind of England in 1912?
Yeah, I mean, the book kind of divides into three sections, really. So the first part is set in what I think of as Downton Abbey world. So, you know, she's married into a family of aristocrats. Then we have the Titanic section, and then we have the New York section, which is where she ends up. So I always start by reading tons of books and really sort of immersing myself in the period. I did watch quite a lot of Downton Abbey, and I also watched quite a lot of Series 5 of The Crown, which is the kind of start of the falling apart of Charles and Diana's marriage and Camilla coming into it. And there are parallels with the story of Eleanor and Frederick's marriage. So that was all quite fun. It's really nice to be able to watch Downton Abbey as part of your research process.
Absolutely. Can we hear a section, please, Fran, before
I'll read you just the beginning, which is very short. On the day I stole another woman's life, I saw New York for the first time, against a charcoal grey sky with rain teeming down in sheets. It wasn't much of a sight, but I didn't care, and I don't suppose anyone else standing there on the deck, soaked to the skin, did either. We were all just desperate to see land, though the downpour was so heavy that the buildings looming up ahead were no more than vague shapes. Suddenly the grey was lit up. A flotilla of tugboats sped towards us, cameras pointing up, flashbulbs exploding, men yelling questions. Damn journalists, said someone behind me. Parasites, the lot of them. I stepped back quickly into the shadows. I'd been concentrating so hard on what I was about to do, thinking through how it could work, if it could work, and telling myself it was the only way. I'd not given a thought to the fact that we'd be news. But of course we were. Over 1,000 people had died on a ship that was claimed to be unsinkable, and we were the ones left to tell the story. Well, I wouldn't be telling them mine.
It's such an intriguing opening. So, as a writer of historical fiction, I'm always really interested in accuracy and how we kind of cross the line between fiction and fact. And are there people that get in touch with you to say, "Oh, you got that bit wrong"?
Oh yeah, definitely. I've had that with my previous books. It's usually only really quite a small thing. And to be honest, I always think, well, do you know what? I've given someone the gift of feeling superior, and that's quite a nice thing to give. I try and make the books accurate. Of course I do, all historical novelists do. But primarily I think my job is to entertain, is to tell a good story. So I try and worry less about, have I said someone's wearing a green skirt and they didn't, green skirts weren't fashionable in 1912, then does the reader empathise with my characters? Do they want to keep turning the pages? But yeah, you do get that. And I'm absolutely expecting that with this book because there are so many Titanic nerds out there.
Did you go back and watch the Titanic film?
I'd never seen the film. I'd never seen it. I wasn't really what I gather is called a Titanorak. I had a vague interest. We all know the story, don't we? But I wasn't something I was really fascinated by. So I'd never seen the film, and it was I deliberately waited until I basically had the first draft down because you don't want to accidentally steal anything from the story. So yeah, I watched the film quite late on, and that was quite interesting because so I've had already a couple of people say, oh, I don't think that that was right. So I had someone, this is how nitpicking it can be. There's a scene when the ship starts to go down, they let out steam from the engines, I think, to sort of cool them down. And I have a character saying, there's a fearful noise up on deck, they're letting out steam through the funnels. And somebody who read an early copy said, I think you'll find the steam wasn't being let out through the funnels, it was being let out through steam pipes attached to the funnels. And you think, well, okay, but this character is standing on deck in a sinking ship. That's not what he's going to be thinking about. But yeah, I think there will be quite a lot of that. And I did think when I watched the film, well, if that hasn't blown people's mind, I think I might be all right.
Have you seen or heard of the musical in London?
I have heard of it. I haven't seen it. It slightly blows my mind how you could make the Titanic into a musical, but I suppose if you can do it with Les Miserables, which is a very sad story, you could do it with Titanic.
Yes, absolutely. That might be your next research trip, Fran.
Maybe.
So, let's talk about the scenes in New York. What was your research process behind them? Did you find out anything really fascinating?
Yeah, so Eleanor, when she decides to disappear, she steals the identity of someone who has been hired as her maid and is travelling to New York to join relatives she'd never met. The classic immigrant story of that time, they live in the tenements. They're in a building where 20 families are sharing a block of outside toilets. They're living five to a room and now seven to a room when she turns up with her child. So it was really interesting how poor people were in that situation, but also that there was this feeling of we've all come here to make a better life. We will live like this now because we will have a future. And they were all looking forward and thinking, well, we might not have that future, but our kids will have that future. So there was good free education, there was lots of work. So immigrants from all over the world were living cheek by jowl, and as far as I could tell, getting on pretty well, which is, that was really nice to reflect the kind of community spirit that they had there. So I did really enjoy writing those sections.
So, what's next for you, Fran? Is it more historical fiction?
It is more historical fiction. My next book that I'm working on at the moment is based on a true story about the woman who founded the first British ladies football club in Victorian London. And obviously, as you can imagine, at that time, the idea of women, I mean, the idea of women playing football gives some people problems even now. So you can imagine how much opposition they had. And it's about how they start the club, and they're largely women who've never played football before, but they fall in love with the game, and then they have to fight for their chance to keep playing.
That sounds right up my street. You'll have seen me smiling from ear to ear about that. So, Fran, you, of course, are a writer in Brighton, and it would be remiss of me not to ask about, where, how you find that, and how you find being part of the creative community here.
It's been amazing. I mean, I only moved to Brighton 6 years ago, and I didn't really know anybody. And finding this community of writers has been amazing. I mean, you can't chuck a rock in Brighton and not hit a writer. It's easier to find a writer than a plumber. But that's fantastic because it is quite a lonely business. You are spending most of your time on your own with imaginary people. So it's really nice that there are lots of people you can just meet for a coffee, brainstorm. I mean, we have the amazing Real Writers Circle, which has been such a great opportunity to connect. I've met some really good friends there. They have some great speakers. I've learned a lot. And there are all sorts of writers' groups, there are little informal ones. So I think it would be hard to imagine a better place to be a writer, really.
Would you ever set anything here?
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah. If I could find the right historical story, I definitely would. So there's a book I really love called The Secret Photographs by Jackie Bluesey, who's a local author, and that is set in Brighton, in Victorian Brighton. And I'm quite envious of her that she found that story. So now I'm on the lookout for one for myself.
Watch out, Jackie. Yes, we had Jackie on the show a few months ago, so you can listen back to the podcast episode of that. Thank you so much for joining us, Fran. How can we find and follow you?
You can find me on what I still call Twitter as at Fran Quinn, and on Instagram, Fran Quinn 21, and on Facebook, I am author Frances Quinn.
The Lost Passenger is out now in hardback with Simon and Schuster. I am really, really excited to have our next guest, DE White, on the show to talk about a writing workshop which she is doing in Horsham on the 27th of March called Develop Your Criminal and Your Hero. Daisy, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you introduce yourself? You haven't been on the show before.
I haven't. I'm really excited to join you. So I write as DE White. I was born in Brighton, so a lot of my books, I think we're coming up to about 15 or 16 books now, are set in Brighton, whether really or fictionally. And I've been in the industry a long time, since 2012. And I now live quite near the South Coast, so still a great fondness for Brighton, and still very much inspired by all things that happen down in Brighton.
I would love to know where you kind of pick your ideas from. Do you read lots of news articles? Are you always, eavesdropping in conversations?
Absolutely. I am the kind of person who stands in the queue in Sainsbury's thinking, oh, I wonder what she's doing. I wonder what he does. And I think that's such a writer thing, though, isn't it? You always look at people or situations and you think, what if that happened? What if he crossed the road 5 minutes earlier? What if she did that? And it is such a writer thing. But Brighton wise, I get inspired every time I go down there. I still consider it, I haven't lived there for a long time, but I still consider it my home. So anyone, going along the beach, the huge amount of people that's there in the summer, the fact that hardly anyone's there in the winter, but there's still loads of people in Brighton, things going on. The port down near Portslade and Shoreham, that's a huge source of inspiration in pretty much all my books. So it can really be anything at all.
So you're prolific. You are averaging at least a book a year. How do you keep that momentum going?
I did have a blip a couple of years ago. I was writing three books a year for two different publishers, and it was going really well, and I was like, wow, I've made it. I'm a writer, I'm making a living writing, a very small living, but making writing. And unfortunately, my royalties didn't continue at the same pace that they had previously. They didn't go up, and I had a bit of a breakdown actually, a complete burnout, and I couldn't write for 6 months. So I was very much forced to go, okay, what's the cause of this? The cause is concern financially. I'm literally doing a shift job to support my writing, and I'm not loving either of them. So I changed career completely, and I have a career that I love outside of writing, and I consider writing my hobby, which means that I love it again, and I've been able to write, and it's just such a pleasure to have the words coming and be able to write again. So a lot of that support that I got from then is from the writing community, fellow authors and readers. Everyone kind of understands as soon as you put it out there. So I feel like it's really important to be honest that it's not all rainbows and glitter all of the time.
Absolutely. It's really refreshing to hear you talk about that. And I'm just glad you're writing again. So I would love to talk about the publishing industry. So you've got experience from digital first publishing, from Bigger Five publishing, but also more recently, self-publishing. I'd love to hear about your experiences and your observations of the industry.
So I think self-publishing was very big, wasn't it? Around about sort of 2009, maybe. Suddenly it became very much the thing to do, but it was very much in its infancy. And now, with more and more digital publishers popping up, I think the self-publishing is coming back a lot in the last couple of years. Authors, particularly experienced authors, have said to themselves, "Well, do you know what? I've got this book that's been on my laptop for ages. Maybe I should pop this out." And last year I self-published a book called Blindsided. It's the first in a new Gang Lang thriller series, and I was really surprised, firstly, how lovely it was to do. It was wonderful working with a cover designer myself. It was wonderful. I mean, lucky with all my editors, I should say, that all my publishers, I've had fantastic editors. So each time I work with someone new, I kind of feel like they make the book 100 times better. So I went back to an editor I previously worked with and said, "You're freelance. Would you be free to do this?" And he was like, "Yeah, of course." So working with an editor that I've worked with, obviously the book was properly edited, properly proofread, properly formatted, so I could be confident I was putting out the best version I possibly could. And I was so shocked how well it did. I was really shocked because I know partly, I do honestly believe you can work super, super hard in the publishing industry, but you have to have a tiny bit of luck as well. And a lot of the time, it's just the luck that's lacking. And I was amazed that the book Blindsided came out last May and it's already had over 1 million page reads. It's selling incredibly well. The comparison with my royalties and my kind of sales from other publishers and from speaking to friends in the industry that who are also dipping a toe in self-publishing, they're kind of saying the same, that actually self-publishing is so easy to do now. And for those of us who do have a wonderful platform of readers already, the readers don't really care where the book comes from. It has to be beautiful and it has to be the best we can give them, but they don't mind whether it's self-published or traditionally published. So it was really surprising and lovely.
I think so often there's so much snobbery in the industry, and people in publishing forget that readers want a good book, and a good book is a good book. And that's kind of it, really. It doesn't need to be more complicated than that.
No, that's exactly it. It has to be beautiful and it has to be a story that you've put your whole authentic writerly self into. And obviously, if it's well received, it doesn't really matter which publisher it comes from. I know that I'm such a prolific reader, and honestly, my TBR pile is just piled high. But I don't tend to look who the publisher is unless I get to the end of the book and go, "Oh, that was really good." And then I'll note the author and I might have a quick look at the publisher because then I'll want to know, maybe do they publish similar authors? Do they publish something else in this genre that I might like? But I don't go and look, and I know that you probably don't either. You don't go and look, "Right, that's a HarperCollins book on the bind. That one, that's not, so I'm not." And you kind of don't differentiate, do you?
Not with the big ones. I think often I will seek out books from small presses because I like what they put out. So kind of, but in terms of like the big ones, it doesn't really matter to me who publishes a book. And it doesn't matter, if people self-publish, because I think you can do it really well.
Yeah, you shouldn't. I think you shouldn't tell the difference. I think if you walked into, so one of the reasons I love working with Waterstones in Horsham is that they are so supportive of writers at every level, which is one of the reasons why they've started to do these mini workshops. But equally, you can say to them, "Oh, I've got a self-published book out," and they'll be like, "Oh, wow, how's it going? How's it?" In the same way that you could go, "Oh, I've had a traditionally published book out," and they'll still go, "How's it going? You're a local author. Tell us how you're finding it." And I find that so refreshing. That obviously Waterstones is a big chain. It's really important to support small independent bookshops as well. But there's a place for everyone on the high street. I do firmly believe that. And the support from the booksellers is incredible for us.
Shall we talk about your workshop at Waterstones Horsham? This is a nice segue.
Yes, let's talk. So March the 27th, the Waterstones Crime Writing Workshop. It's the second one I've done in this series, and this is about character development. So this is developing your criminal, and I think on the blurb, also developing your hero. So it's very much about, do we need a likable protagonist? Do we need someone with lots of flaws? Perhaps in crime writing, moving slightly away from the female detective who has massive backstory and lots going on, and how you can kind of put your own twist on that, because everyone has their own amazing ideas. So it's always a really fun hour. It starts at 5:45 in the evening, and it lasts until 6:45, and we generally have a Q&A and a chat, and then we have to get thrown out by lovely Tabitha, because we're all nattering about books. It's just such a lovely, lovely group, and everyone has such amazing ideas. When I do the workshops there, it's very much about the people who come and their writing. It's not about me standing there talking about my author journey, because quite frankly, no, nobody cares. This is about them, and this is about how they're developing their characters and their writing. So everyone brings a notepad and a book, or a MacBook and, whatever, their phone that they tend to work on. And we do some really intensive work, and I make sure that I go around and we do some one-to-one. We do have a laugh, but also it's really nice to get an idea of how people are feeling. Are they ready to publish? Have they published previously? Do they need a bit more inspiration? Some people just come not because they're writing in the crime genre, but just because it's a group of really nice, like-minded people. There's coffee and biscuits, and it's Waterstones, and we can breathe in the book air, and it's just a really lovely group, actually.
And it's only a fiver.
It's only a fiver. It is, yeah. It's an absolute bargain. I think it's one of those things that I do love doing events in bookshops. I don't know why. Probably because then I go and buy lots of books afterwards. But it is a really nice thing to do. And I think the writing community in particular within the Southeast, we are very close-knit. So it doesn't really matter what genre you're in. I've got about five WhatsApp groups I'm in. So one of them is called, we've just called it Local Writers, and we tend to meet up at a local cafe once every couple of months. There's about 12 or 14 of us. We can't always all make it, and we are a massive mix of genres. We've got romance writers, we've got hisfic, we've got a ghost writer. Everyone meets up and kind of exchanges views on what's going on, which is great. But the crime, I think probably because I'm a crime writer, the events I tend to attend are things like The Dark Side of Brighton, which was created and organised by a fellow writer, Donna Moffat, who also reviews. I don't know when she actually finds time to get any sleep, because she reads and reviews and writes herself and organises. But The Dark Side of Brighton is actually another event. It's on March the 8th at the Old Ship Hotel in Brighton. And that's a day event, and it runs from 10 in the morning until 5:30 in the evening. And it has around 6 to 7 panels of authors generally from the southeast, but they do come further afield. And there are some quite big names on there. But it's a really fun event, and it brings everyone together. There's an excellent bar at the end. I think everyone normally heads off to the pub. But it's just a really nice way of meeting authors that perhaps you admire. Like, a lot of the time, I perhaps wouldn't have dared go up to people like Graham Bartlett, for instance, and said, "Oh, hi, you're a writer too." But meeting people in this kind of smaller event setting means that you genuinely can ask them questions about, about their new book, things that you've just read their book and you're really excited, and you want to know where they got the inspiration from and how they got published. So this is the kind of event where you can certainly do that. And of course, there's loads of crime expertise. It's amazing how many crime writers are actually former police officers or lawyers. I do kind of wonder about that a lot. But that's another fantastic event, and that one's down in Brighton on March the 8th.
Daisy, thank you so much for joining us. Your new book, Everyone Is Lying, is out on the 31st of March. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Miff Tristram and Corinne Perlman join me from the first graphic novel competition to talk about the 2025 awards. Miff, Corinne, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Great to
Thank
be
you.
here.
Miff, for anyone listening who isn't sure what a graphic novel is, what is it?
Well, you might think of it as a comic in longer form, I guess.
Could be a short book, a long book, but the crucial difference between it and a normal novel is that, of course, it's all done in pictures and words working together.
Corinne, why is the graphic novel form important to tell stories? What can it do that prose can't?
It's not that prose can't, it just is kind of a format in entirely its own right that conveys thoughts from one reader to another through words and pictures, as Miff said, working together. So actually it's almost like the form where other forms can't quite reach, but somehow the combination of words and pictures gives a kind of a huge openness to conveying experiences and pictures that are sort of really kind of quite unique, but very kind of open to everyone, both as readers and also as creators too.
So we're going to talk a bit about the competition now before I ask you both what your favourite graphic novels are. So have that running around your head. But Miff, can you tell us, please, about the first graphic novel award?
I can tell you from the point of view of somebody who entered it, two goes in a row and was shortlisted both times. So it's one of the few opportunities out there, I think, for people who create graphic novels. And by the way, there is a massive community of people who draw comics and make graphic novels, often just working from their own bedrooms, solitary confinement, and then they will come together in events like Thought Bubble or the Lakes International Comics Arts Festival, which is where the community kind of gathers. But the point that I'm making, I guess, is that there is all this talent out there, and up until recently, there hasn't really been an outlet for it. So people tend to self-publish, they might sell their own work at these festivals and so on. If they're very, very lucky, they might get an agent or a publisher, and then, like, the very, very few books are the ones that you would see on the shelf in, say, Waterstones. So the first graphic novel competition, from my point of view, is a whole new opportunity for people to get their work seen by professional agents and publishers. And, if they're very lucky and they win, then they get a publishing contract.
It is amazing to have a competition with a guarantee of a publishing contract at the end of it. So, Corinne, I know that you are the founder of this competition, which started a few years ago. Can you tell us, please, about some of the success stories from it and what you're most proud of in what you've seen over the last few years?
I'm proud, first of all, about all the entrants and the fact that it's usually run every couple of years, and so each time there have been more and more entries. The quality of entry is always absolutely kind of outstanding, sort of giving witness to what Miff has said about the number of comic creators there are out there. And the few opportunities they have. So, first of all, it's the entrance that I'm most proud of. I can't believe how high the standard is. Secondly, the kind of individual success stories. The very first graphic novel competition we ran was in 2012 at Myriad. Myriad, the publisher, were the founders, and this latest competition is. The latest award process is now with Self-Made Hero, the independent publisher Self-Made Hero. Back in 2012, Gareth Brooks won with The Black Project, and I can remember seeing his was an early entry with his artwork and so on. I just thought, oh my God, this is amazing, I remember the judging committee where we had a discussion, was it even a graphic novel? Kind of, some people didn't think the form he used sort of quite qualified. So it's always had that kind of wonderful energy of allowing different forms in and so on. And Gareth has since gone on to publish kind of three graphic novels, and indeed he's also a comic scholar as well now, and has just won a prestigious academic award on comics. So very proud of Gareth. Another success story, apart from Miffs, of course. I'm very conscious that it's been fantastic to see how her work has developed and is now celebrated and so on. Kind of fingers, we will get that publisher, fingers crossed. But But you know, Miff is a good example of self-publishing herself and has had actually a couple of books, you know, self-published, but then also has an American publisher now. And the other person I wanted to mention was Sabah Khan, who she was shortlisted for the 2018 competition, and Myriad published her book, The Roles We Play, and that was one, you know, that's now available in the States, and she has a kind of a huge following and so on, kind of a lot of work as a kind of comics artist as well as an architect in her spare time, and she won the best book by a writer of color. That was the Jalak Prize in 2023. So those are kind of three examples.
So, Miff, obviously you have entered and been shortlisted for the competition. So, do you have any tips for anyone that's thinking, oh, I'd really like to enter, but I'm not quite sure?
Yeah, I think people might perceive graphic novels as quite a difficult thing to get started in because obviously you have to be good at writing, you have to be good at drawing, you have to understand all the ways that those two elements can come together to make more than the sum of their parts. But I would also say that because of this kind of DIY culture in comics, and by the way, as Corinne was speaking, I was thinking, yeah, it's important to note that like there is no kind of stigma around self-publishing in comics. And I know that sometimes in literary circles, if you say, oh, I'm self-published, people roll their eyes a little bit. And for whatever reason, that just hasn't happened in the comics community, which I think is a nice thing. But anyway, I think my main tip would be like, don't overthink it. Just start. Just express yourself. You will discover the more that you draw and the more you try the different ways of expressing yourself through comics and the things that the medium can do. But there's such a vast array of different ways that people approach it. And I've seen brilliant comics that really the person involved cannot draw much more than a stick man, but they do so with such good expression, or the story carries it so well. Because you've got these two halves, almost the story can help carry the visual side of it, or vice versa. The visual side can really pull you along into the story.
Before I ask you how we can enter the award and what we need to do so, quick fire question. Corinne, can you recommend three graphic novels to us, please?
Coma by Zahra Slattery is a kind of a very moving graphic memoir that just sort of it like resonates with so many people about her experience of being inside a coma. It's really kind of based just like that, but it's the story of what her family went through as well as her experience of that. Other books, you know, kind of some very obvious things, but if you haven't read Alison Bechdel, please do. You know, I would recommend anything by Alison Bechdel. Her, you know, most famous one perhaps is kind of Fun Home, about sort of growing up in a funeral parlor. And there's kind of just so much in there, you know, kind of exciting stories apart from anything else. But obviously, the analysis and psychology for which she's very well known for. Yeah, I'm going to fluff up here because there are so many. I don't want to go on any further. I'm going to hand over to Miff.
Do you know what? Last time I was asked this, I didn't have an answer at the top of my head, so I planned ahead and I've written a list. But I wouldn't disagree with either of your choices, Corinne. They were both really good ones. So I would say anything by Posy Simmonds. So I was reading Posy Simmonds when I was a small child. She used to have a strip in The Guardian, and she's just the master or the mistress of her form. In like it just seems so effortless the way that she can draw gestures and positions of people and different faces and even like all the plates and cups in a kitchen background and so on. I really, really admire her artistry. Then when I started getting really serious about comics, one of the first ones that I really admired was by Mariko and Gillian Tamaki, who are a cousin duo. It's called This One Summer, and it's like for me, that is a really fantastic example of how great drawing and a great story can come together and just get a message across. Like it's one of those stories that on the face you could read it really quickly and you could think, oh yeah, that was just a story, but actually then it sits with you and it percolates and you realize that there's more depth to it. And then for my final one, I'm going to choose Fumio Obata, who is a Japanese artist living in the United Kingdom. He wrote a book called Just So Happens, and it's about the experience, I guess, of somebody who's chosen to make their life in one country, but then finds that they're being pulled back to their original nation. In this case, it's about a funeral, so he's pulled back to attend a funeral, but visually, it's just so amazing. And I remember looking at it and just thinking, how can I attain this level of perfection? And I don't think I have yet reached that level of perfection. But I also think that if you draw every day, your drawing gets better and better. And so I feel like I'm on a track towards that level.
Miff Corinne, thank you so much for joining us. Corinne, quickly before we go, how can we enter the award and what do we need to do so?
The details are on the website firstgraphicnovel.co.uk, and we ask entrants to submit between 15 to 20 pages of their graphic novel in progress. And they might have more of it, but we only want to see a maximum of 20 pages. It can be in black and white or colour. They need to make a kind of one page summary or synopsis or blurb about what their book is about, kind of how they intend it to develop. There's an entry fee of £10, or kind of £5 for concessions. Please ask questions. I mean, we ask people to submit digitally as well as kind of in, it physically. So there's, we admire everyone for submitting in the first place because it's a lot of hard work. But believe me, it's worth it. And they will get all the entrants will get some kind of feedback. The long list will get feedback from as well as from the judges, also from a literary agent. And the shortlist will be showcased at events and so on. And then the winner will get published by a publishing contract from Self-Made Hero. £500.
And £500. Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. And you can find details in the show notes on the podcast and over on our Instagram page and the link in our bio. I will pop a link to enter. With rousing talks from best-selling authors Kit DeWall and Annie Garthwaite, the Forthright Festival takes place over 2 days in Brighton and Crawley. Expect inspiring workshops, lively discussions with authors, publishers, and industry professionals. Forthright works in partnership with New Writing South and is supported by the Arts Council in England. It will take place in Brighton on the 15th of March and in Crawley on the 30th of March. And I am joined by the founders of Forthright Festival, Sam Johnson and Anna Jefferson, to talk about it. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, thanks for having us, Anna.
Anna, can you tell us about the thinking behind Forthright?
So Sam and I have been working with women writers for about the last 5 years in varying degrees and running workshops and panel discussions. And one of the things that became really apparent was the lack of platform for women writers over 50. There seems to become a bit of a drop-off point unless you are a megastar, big best-selling author. And the more we started talking to women writers, the more we realised that there was a gap in the market for this. As far as we're aware, there isn't any festival that celebrates women writers over 50. And the more we started thinking about it, we thought we're in a really brilliant place to be able to start doing this ourselves. This is the first year of Forthright, so this is our pilot year, and we're so excited about the range of writers that we've got and the support that we've had so far for the festival.
Sam, why is it important to showcase underrepresented writers?
I think that mostly it's just because people want to hear their stories, and I think that the more different stories that people can hear and listen to, it must create understanding of different people's situations and where they've come from.
Anna, can you tell us, please, about some of the highlights on the lineup in terms of the panels that you've got?
Oh, we've got some absolutely brilliant panelists. So, as you explained beforehand, the festival runs over 2 days. So, we have a festival day in Brighton, which is on the Saturday, the 15th of March. And so, there's two panels running. One of them is fantastic. It's focusing on debuts over 50. And so this particular panel, we've got a keynote to start with Annie Garthwaite, and she's talking about her experience into writing and about debuting over 50. And then the other panelists are Pam Williams, Yvonne Bailey-Smith, and we've got Katie Massey, who's chairing it. And we expect that this is going to be a really lively, fantastic discussion, especially seeing as some of the writers have only recently been debuted as well. So really looking forward to hearing about their experiences. And then the second panel in Brighton is around taking up space. And this is going to be chaired by Frances Quinn, who is a brilliant author. She's also local to Brighton as well. So that's going to be fantastic. Then Reshma Rui, Yvette Edwards and Shona Abiyankar. And I think, again, just having that range as well of people who've been working in publishing and in writing in different capacities, I think it's going to be really interesting for all of our people who are coming along to find out about those different ways that you can do it. And there's not just one way to get into writing. And then as our second day of Forthright is on Sunday, the 30th of March, which also happens to be Mother's Day. So we're hoping that people will feel that this is a great time to bring their mums or any other significant women in their life along to the festival. So we're starting the afternoon of the panels with a keynote from Kit DeVal that we're super excited about. And then the panel is going to be with Debbie Alper, Umi Singer, Eve Ainsworth, and Dorothy Cumson. And this is talking around resilience and perseverance. Continuing your writing journey in spite of and because of a drive to keep going. And then the final panel of that day is about how to get your work noticed. And this panel is going to be chaired by agent Abby Fellows, and then Kit DeVal, Nicola Williams, and Uju Asika are going to be talking then as well. So yes, we think it's going to be a real highlight of both days, the panel discussions.
Can you tell us about the Writers' Showcase in Crawley on the 30th?
Yes, this is an event that we're really excited about. This is a bunch of fantastic women that we've been working with now, some of them on and off for the last 5 years through creative writing workshops. And this is going to all come together in a culmination of a showcase of their work, which is going to be, we're using the inspiration of inspiring women to be able to then platform work. We imagine that this might be a combination of short stories and poetry and a whole range of different things that people have been writing over the last few weeks. So this will be a lunchtime session, which will be open for anybody to come and support and celebrate. So yes, that's going to be our showcase, and we feel that this will be an opening to, we hope, a continuing group of women who will continue to write together following this.
So, as well as these wonderful panel discussions, you also have a really exciting dynamic workshop offering. Sam, I'd love it if you could tell us a bit about the workshops in Brighton and Crawley.
Yeah, of course. So I'll start with Brighton, as that's the day that's coming up first. So we've got a really interesting session that's opening the day called Taking Control of Your Writing Life. This is your time. And that's with Anna Hayward and Anna Davidson. And that is all about just exploring different ways of getting the most out of your writing. And they're thinking about the big questions of why people write, what success looks like, and the kind of challenges that you face as a woman in your 50s. And also, looking for support and community. And I think that'll be a really interesting session. And then we've got Sharon Dougal, who's doing a creative writing workshop on writing people, and that's about rounding out fictional characters and making them feel real, making your characters leap off the page instead of fading into the background. So that's an hour with Sharon. And then the other one in Brighton, we've got a really interesting session, which is an introduction to graphic novels. And so the idea with this one is to there'll be a little bit of time in the library where people can look at the offering of graphic novels and see if anything is interesting to them, but also tell people kind of how different ways to access graphic novels as a medium. And then there's a chance to kind of make a zine of your own. So I think that's a really interesting creative session. And that's with Corinne Perlman and Hannah Berry, who was the UK Comics Laureate. So yeah, I think that was going to be very exciting. And then in Crawley, we've got a few different sessions as well, which we've got a really interesting one with Alina Azada, and that is about the menopause journey. So it's a 1 hour session and looking at the kind of individual menopause. So that's all about having a supportive space to reflect and write together about what that might mean for each woman. And then we've got a brilliant session about discovering poetry, and the theme of that is home, and that's with Parveen Khan, who's local to Crawley, and she's a brilliant kind of community activist and poet. Then there's the Rest Experience, which was with Akilah Richards, and that is a really it's a creative response to about the exploitative system of kind of capitalism, and it's an artistic resistance about a practice of rest, basically. It's creating restful encounters internally and externally, and as a necessary disruption and a realigning of purpose. So that's going to be really lovely. I haven't done that before. You've done it, haven't you, Anna? And
I think everybody who's done this has just felt absolutely revived by the end of it. So yes, I think we're definitely going to see if we can sneak off to go to Akilah's session.
Oh, I'm such a big fan of Akilah and Akilah's work. So what if I am, which I am, under 50? And what if I am a man? Is this festival for me?
Absolutely. This festival is for everyone. This festival is a celebration, and the festival is focusing on women writers over 50 to be able to showcase and celebrate and champion their work. But the festival is intended for everybody, and we really hope that that comes through with the programming and the lineup, and that we have a wide and varied mix of people coming, learning from each other, talking with each other, creating network and celebration. And we really hope that that we get enough kind of goodwill and championing of this festival that we can make this into an annual event.
Anna, Sam, thank you so much for joining us on the Brighton Book Club. How can we get tickets and find out more?
So to get tickets, if you visit the website, which is forthright.uk, forthright spelt forthright.uk, and you can find out more there about us as an organisation and the things that we do, and as well how to get involved in the festival.
Writer of high concept thrillers Brooke Robinson has recently moved to Brighton, and Brooke got in touch with me to come and have a chat on the Brighton Book Club about her books, and I'm desperate to know what brought her very far to Brighton. Brooke, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thanks for having me.
So what brought you here?
I moved from Sydney via London, really just over the last sort of year or so, coming down on occasional weekends to visit a friend, and the place really grew on me. I think there's something about having such a high concentration of like wonderful cafes and public spaces to write in is really important for people that spend most of their lives working from home on their own. I think that really appealed to me. Whereas, you know, in a city like Sydney or London, if you want to kind of go to a beautiful cafe and then a library, it generally means getting on the bus or the tube. But I walk to a different cafe here every day so far, have somewhere new to write from. And yeah, it's just lovely.
So we can find you in a different cafe every day in Brighton. You could probably do it for a year.
Yeah, I think so. I'm wondering, I mean, I have already done a few double ups, but I certainly could go somewhere new every day, I'm sure.
Can you, Brooke, please tell us a bit about your writing and your journey to becoming a successful author?
I used to be a playwright until about the beginning, kind of 2020. I guess, like a lot of folks, the pandemic, I had a couple of play commissions for theatres in Australia. So I wrote a couple of plays that year. But like a lot of people, I just had that extra time to sort of step back and look at my work from, a more kind of macro level and ask myself, am I really doing what I want to be doing? Do I want to be writing plays forever? I had a lot of ideas for stories in the bottom drawer that for various reasons didn't suit theatre. One of the great things about theatre is the restriction of the form, but it does mean that a lot of stories that you might want to tell just simply won't work on stage. So I got to, the beginning of the pandemic and asked myself those questions and thought that the stories that I wanted to be telling going forward were really best suited to writing a novel. So I wrote my first novel, The Interpreter, that year. Maybe it led into 2021 a little bit as well. And really went cold turkey on theatre and kind of made the complete switch.
So you write quite high concept books. Can you firstly kind of give us the elevator pitches for your published books and then tell us a bit about where you get your inspiration?
Yeah, The Interpreter is about a language interpreter who works with the Met Police in London. And she decides in court and police interview rooms to deliberately mistranslate witness statements in order to help convict people if she decides they're guilty. So she goes rogue and kind of becomes a bit of a vigilante. And The Negotiator is about a peaceful climate protest in a London museum. One of the protesters is radicalized and has a gun, takes people hostage. One of the hostages is an off-duty police officer who years ago had failed the exam to become a hostage negotiator. So here is her opportunity to try and prove herself and negotiate their way out from the inside.
And where did these ideas come to you?
I mean, generally always from the news. And it's the same with all of my plays, actually. It's usually just something that I read in a newspaper and then kind of take it from there. So The Interpreter, I'd read a story in The Guardian. There's a column in The Guardian that's I think it's called Experience, where people write in first person and talk about interesting things about their lives. Not always their work, but often it is. And someone said, I think she used the phrase like, I'm the voice for the voiceless. I go to work, I speak on behalf of murderers, sometimes serial killers, sometimes victims of crime as well. And I just thought, oh my God, I mean, I just can't imagine having a job that has such intense emotional stakes. Spend a lot of time kind of Googling, wanting to find out more about it. Yeah, so I suppose that's my answer. Something in the news that I don't know anything about that then I'm intrigued by. I'm not a fan of write what you know. I'm a fan of write what you don't know and want to know about.
Can we please hear an extract from The Negotiator?
I'm going to read the prologue. The bullet enters Tia's thigh, close to where her brother will look for the star-shaped mole when asked to identify her body. The green carpet is moving towards her. Flung onto her side, Tia lands hard on her left arm. Pop, pop, pop sounds bounce between her ears, flashbangs. The force of the grenades is knocking artwork to the floor. The heavy frames could be falling onto someone, but it's too dark or too bright to see properly, and there's probably nothing she can do to help them. On the ground, Tia feels her way to the wall, any wall. A palm goes to each thigh, no wound. That was her own thumb which drove into her skin. The firearms team are in the room now, but the bullet was her imagination. She will not bleed out, and these aren't her final breaths. Relief comes, but it isn't much because she has been thinking about dying all day. Death no longer frightens her. Fear requires energy, and Tia is too tired for it now. They all must be. Her hand finally hits something solid. She's made it to the side of the room. Tia stands and leans against the plaster, making herself as flat as she can. She's safe here, and now she has some sense of direction. The windows out onto the road are to her right, and the doors to the rest of the museum to her left. That's where the specialist officers are coming from. Through the smoke in front of her, human shapes start to take form. There are bodies on the carpet. Alive? She cannot just wait here for it to be over and help to collect the dead. Back on all fours, Tia leaves the wall and crawls to the nearest hostage. Broken glass crunches underneath her knees. The noise of the police boots, the guns, the shields, everything is so intense. Her teeth gnaw into her cheeks. Tia reaches someone. There's a pulse. They're shaking, but they're okay. She sees more human shadows. There is no real furniture in here and nowhere to shelter. When the police burst in, everyone dropped in place, and the unlucky was stood near the doors or in the center of the room, exposed. The white haze meant to disorient the gunman is stopping Tia from working out who is who. But it's those hostages in the middle of the room who are most in need. Tia rises to her feet, keeping as low as possible. She moves quickly. She sees two bodies lying in the path of the entering police. She'll go to them. Are they hurt? She won't drag them out of the danger zone in case it makes their injuries worse. The pop pops continue. The two hostages are about 10 yards apart. She can't get to them both. Suddenly it's obvious who they are and she must choose. Pick one hostage, shield them. The only thing she can give now is herself. Tia's last chance today to get something right. It's not a matter of who most deserves to live, but who needs her more and what her instinct is saying. The decision is made somewhere deep inside her body and she's running the last few steps. She finds them breathing. No blood, they're all right. She lies down, covers them, becoming the barrier between them and all this chaos which she couldn't prevent. Tia will stay like this, stretched across the hostage until she gets a gentle tap from one of the police officers telling her it's done. A powerful heat explodes in her calf, suddenly wet and sticky, blood. Now she's shot for real. It's only the lower leg, a stray bullet, probably just a graze. The shock is the issue. She's read this. Don't give in to it, she tells herself. Forget it. Pressure is building behind her left eye. Her neck twisted, face squashed against the floor. A sleeping position her optometrist once told her is very bad for the glands. What a thing to think right now, but she knows this thought arrived because the outside world is close. In a moment, police will be in control and the siege and this whole day will be over. Her life with optometrists and health advice, her boyfriend, her friends, and her Tuesday morning swim is almost within touching distance. But Tia won't get back to it, she realizes, not properly. Even if she survives these next few minutes, she will never leave this museum.
Brooke, how can people find and follow you and get their hands on a copy of your books?
Thank you. The Negotiator came out in paperback last week. The Interpreter's already in paperback, so they should be available in all good bookstores, as they say. And I'm sure all of the good bookstores at Brighton. Instagram, I think, is probably the best place to find me. I am Brooke Robinson, author.
What are you most looking forward to getting involved with now you've moved to Brighton?
I've already been to a couple of amazing events at Waterstones, which has been lovely. Next week, I'm going to the first event of the Real Writers Circle, which I'm sure probably most listeners know about. So, yeah, apart from trying every single cafe and riding my way around town, I'm really looking forward to all the book festivals and all the events that are going to be walking distance from my flat.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club. If you are a writer in Brighton, I would love you to join me at the West Hill Hall on Saturday, the 5th of April, for a day-long writing retreat. This is a tried and tested format that helps you focus on your work, meet like-minded people, and enjoy an industry expert Q&A at the end of the day. Tea, coffee and biscuits are available and on tap all day. You don't have to lift a finger. It's a really, really great way to give the time, energy and space to your work and meet like-minded people in the city. You can find details of the writing retreats over at Eventbrite if you just search Daylong Writing Retreat in Brighton, and over on our Instagram page at BTM Book Club we have more details. There's also our Linktree, which is linktree.com/BTN Book Club, and you will be able to find the link there. We would love to see you there, and we will be back next month with more literary goings on in the city, in Brighton and beyond. See you then.